Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. We're glad to have you with us today for another edition of Midrats. And because we are live this week after being absent for a little bit, I want to remind everybody that if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that is where you will find the chat room. And we'd like for everybody to go ahead and scroll down there and join with some of the usual suspects. And if you have some comments about the show you'd like to share, or even some questions that you would like for us to address our guests during the course of the hour, that's a great place to do it. And let's go ahead and just dive right into the show. Really looking forward to today because we're going to talk about a name that, whether you're a nuke power guy or a submariner or not, you know the name. There are a few naval leaders that have had such a legendary reputation for so long in the United States Navy as Admiral Hyman G. Rickover. And if you talk to, I'm a man of a certain age, but if you talk to any submarine officer in their above their late 50s to 60, they're probably going to have a personal story about Admiral Rickover, or just one person removed from Admiral Rickover. And as a result, he has developed a certain aura. Maybe some of it's deserved, maybe some of it isn't, and a certain reputation in our Navy, and not just about his role in creating the nuclear submarine and the nuclear surface force that we have today, but a lot of the culture around it. But there are other parts of the individual, as there is with anybody else, that may not be as well known. And we have an opportunity today to talk to one of the co-editors of the primary source, and that's Admiral Rickover himself. And our guest is no surprise guest to anybody who's been with us at Midrats for a while. He is one of our plank owner guests, Claude Barabé, who with Samuel Limnios co-edited a book that's just out now, and you can find a link to it on the show page, called Rickover Uncensored. Claude, welcome back to Midrats.
Thanks, gentlemen. I appreciate being back on. And for your listeners, if I miss a date or anything here in the next hour, or I mute myself for just a second, I'm fighting a head cold, so I may have to sneeze or cough, and I'll try to spare you from that. So thanks for having me on.
Hey, well, like all great naval professionals, you know how to fight hurt. And we'll start off with an easy one here, is always easy when you're bringing on a book, but I want to add a little twist to it, is I want to ask you just to kick things off and kind of set the table for everybody. Tell us a little bit about your book. Last time we had you on, you were talking about your latest novel in the Connor Stark series, The Philippine Pact, little point there for the latest novel. But this is a work of nonfiction, and I know as a historian and for those that like to read nonfiction, it's really exciting because what we're working here with is we're working with primary sources. So you didn't author this book, you co-edited it, and it is Admiral Rickover in his own words from his private paper. So you know, what else can you tell us about the book? And also tell the listener a little bit how you came to get access to this body of work.
Sure. Let's see, the book itself incorporates the years 1929, when the first letter is available from this collection, to just about a year before his passing. About 95% of the documents that were transcribed and are available in the book are his. There's a few others that I thought were important, things from presidents, when he was captain and did not promote to admiral, an interesting short letter from a young Senator Jack Kennedy who expressed interest. These documents incorporate his letters to his first wife, Ruth, especially 1930s, They include transcriptions of telephone conversations in the 1970s and 80s when you could still do such things. They include letters from a lot of it was fan mail. He was extraordinary at publicity for the Navy. I know people said that he may have been self-serving, but the fact is people knew the Navy. They knew the nuclear Navy because of Admiral Rickover. There are some surprising things in there, too. You always heard, I mean, I think since we're all of a certain age, of these famous interviews that happened between Rickover and midshipmen who were designated for the nuclear Navy. And the first time I came across a transcript of one of the interviews, I said, this is no longer just hearsay. And as a historian, certainly oral histories are important and people remembering. But here was clear evidence of what he was asking them. And I'd say there's probably about a dozen or so of them, at least in the papers that I saw. So that's, and also memoranda for the record, that's very important because at each major meeting from, say, 1950 to 1982 or so, he, after every major meeting, he's writing a memo of what transpired, who was there, what was said, and he kept it. Now, there have been about 9 books about Rickover, and they're all good. Each author brings their expertise that's really important. However, I think the two that are most applicable are the ones by Francis Duncan, who was the official biographer of Admiral Rickover and spent the most time with him. So there are some notes in there that Duncan writes that I thought were also important to put in there, because then you start to see what was Francis Duncan thinking when he was writing this, for example. And in the contract with Francis Duncan, I saw what the limitations were of what he could and couldn't write about. So where did I find this? I want to mention Sam, my co-editor on this first, because Sam is an incredible young academic scholar. He was the assistant archivist over at the Naval Academy, and he's now with another organization. And I think he's got some real promise, and I asked Sam if he would help me out. So he knows this collection. He's got a photographic memory and a great analytical mind. So how did I get all these documents? About 5-6 years ago, I was at dinner at the Army and Navy Club, and a gentleman I knew at another table said, "Hey, Claude, would you come over here? I want to introduce you to some people." And among the people at the table was Eleanor Rickover. So I just sat down and chatted with her for a couple of minutes and didn't think anything of it. I mean, it was certainly, this is Mrs. Rickover. She's legendary as well. And a while later, I was called up to say, "Hey, would you come over to Arlington to meet with Mrs. Rickover?" I said, "Okay, sure." And she still had the condo that she shared with the Admiral. And so I went there. I went there a couple of times. And one of the last times I was there, we chatted. I asked her about how did you meet the Admiral, and she laughed and she said, "Well, I was a Navy nurse at Bethesda. He was just out of surgery, and he had this mess of paper, newspapers all around. And I came in, and I was so upset, I yelled at him and told him to clean up his mess and that I would never clean this up for him again. And he asked me out after that." At the end of the conversation, she and got some paperwork. "Would you consider it?" I said, "Sure." And it was she had shown me what was in the condo that still remained of the Admiral's items, and a Congressional Gold Medal, his rocking chair that he had gotten because of a recommendation from John Kennedy. There's Rolodex, which is phenomenal. A Rolodex which not only has the private numbers of politicians, it has the private numbers to the producer for Das Boot, for economists like John Kenneth Galbraith and Milton Friedman, and this is the archbishops. I mean, it's incredible what's in there. However, there were also these boxes of papers, and so she said, I want to donate these to the Naval Academy Museum, and I want you to have them." I was like, "Oh, okay." So I accepted them on behalf of the Naval Academy, as is my part of my job currently. And as soon as I did that, I signed a memorandum of agreement with the director of the library. I said the most appropriate place for these to be is in the Nimitz Library Special Collections. So the reason why is because The museum doesn't have a staff to catalog and provide research space for researchers for something like this of this scope. So the library staff was phenomenal, and the only reason that this is available to researchers now is because of the extraordinary efforts that the staff went through. And Eleanor passed away a couple of years ago, and a few months ago I got a call from one of the executors of their estate said, hey, the family would like you to come up over to Arlington for the interment. So this was, I guess, late August. And so I was there. It was about 2,000 people or so. And it was just really very moving. It's in a older section of Arlington Cemetery, Section 5, which is not what you think of when you think of Arlington National Cemetery and the lines of symmetrical tombstones, et cetera. And I was just happening to look around at some of the names right around Rickover, and I see Ginsburg, Potter Stewart, about a dozen Supreme Court justices that he was right next to. And it was kind of amusing to me because I said, oh, Jesus, he had private numbers to some of these folks and had conversations with them about the law. So, that's how I came about it and got to know Eleanor. A great lady, really, truly wonderful.
Over. One of the things that struck me in reading through this, Claude, was that he starts out when he was a pretty young man, and you can almost see the maturation progress that he made. I mean, he's a really interesting character, and his first wife and he had quite the intellectual symbiosis. Maybe it's the right word. I mean, they were pinging off each other pretty well. Could you talk a little bit about that relationship and what you see as far as his maturation as time went on?
Absolutely. And I should probably note before that why I decided to go this route rather than write a biography. I was going through all of these documents for months, and I said, I've got to figure out what's the right take on this. And suddenly I came across one of the many letters that he had received about somebody offering to write his biography. I don't think most of them knew about Francis Duncan. They may have, I don't know. And at one point, he responds to the person, look, I've got plenty of boxes of papers in my apartment, and maybe someday somebody will write a biography based on that, but you're not going to get them. And I said, you know what? That's it. I need to not be a historian here. I can select the things that I think are important, but I want to set the stage for other people who are going to access these records. So that's why I went with the edited route of his papers to let him speak for himself. Because in a lot of ways, Rickover censored himself. People are probably going to be surprised with that comment. But he was very careful about managing his image. And that's why he fought so hard against some biographers. This one biographer, for example, the paperwork goes back to 1964, 63, where he says, don't you dare write a biography of me. Movies that they proposed, that Hollywood proposed writing about him, he opposed that. He was very careful and very scripted. So that's why I call this Rickover Uncensored, because you're finally able to, as the reader, hear and read what he is saying. That's a great point, Eagle One, about the letters to his first wife. I think those could be the most important ones. I considered writing a book called The Education of Hyman G. Rickover, because when he's a lieutenant and lieutenant commander, 1929 to 1940, he has daily correspondence with Ruth, his first wife. He didn't see her as an equal. He saw her as his intellectual superior. She had a doctorate in international relations. He had met her at Columbia, had incredible respect for her. And as you're reading these letters, there's part of the letters that say, I'll give you an example of one. This is Rickover writing to Ruth. There is more genuine kindness in this world than I ever believed possible. Wherever you have been, there you have created the desire to be kindly and considerate and tender. This kindness and love which is being showered upon me moves me as nothing has ever moved me before. Okay, it goes on, and this is like almost every letter. But you get a sense now that there's more to the man than what we know of as simply the father of the nuclear navy or the acerbic individual, the person who had ultimate power in the Navy. But in these letters, he's also describing what's happening on the ship or the sub. And I think especially at the point where he's in Shanghai as commander of a ship, as he's watching the Japanese come in for their war against China, these are incredibly important firsthand accounts. So I think about the first quarter or first third of the book is includes his letters to Ruth, because I thought they were so important in his intellectual development. He's talking about the plays he's seeing, the operas he's seeing. He's examining poetry. He's picking apart some of the most difficult Russian books. He's explaining to her that, you know, I'm learning this German language, you know, for a couple of reasons, not the least of which is I want to translate this German officer's book on U-boats. But also Ruth, that wasn't her name, and he was very protective of her. I think the reason why her birth name was Olga Howe, and her father had committed a murder in Germany, and it became the basis for the Howe riots of 1903 or 1907. I think it was 1907.
Oh,
so Rickover was very, very protective of Ruth. And now there are gaps, and I think the most important gap in the collection is 41 to 40, early 45. Where you don't see much. Now, it's possible he didn't write much because he was so busy with war. It's possible that he simply removed those. I don't know.
Yeah, that's one thing that caught me early on in reading that, because like most people before I read this, I had the image of Rickover, the nuclear engineer, and all the stories that I heard as a midshipman and in a GAO from my superiors had known him and his closet rather personally. And it really opened, and I'm sure during the course of the show we'll touch a little bit on the Renaissance nature, but the letters, especially to Ruth that he had, it reminded me, and I agree with you about her and her relationship. It reminded me in some ways about John and Abigail Adams, where the great man was only great in many ways because of the woman that he decided to marry and to make his life partner and for as long as she lived. And it opened up, I think, for later on as he develops as a man and as an officer, whereby reading that great gift of that personal relationship there, it lets you see him in a much more nuanced manner than you otherwise would with just this this post-World War II view that everybody has of Rickover.
Absolutely. In fact, when Ruth passes, he's writing to some of his old friends from the academy or from his ships, his closest friends, and he says, "I never would have been the man today had it not been for Ruth." And I think he was right. Ruth challenged him mentally. And the back and forth on these letters, and I only included a couple of Ruth's letters. I wish there had been room for more. But I think, as historians will realize, there are probably 8 to 10 more books that could be written out of this collection. I think there could be a great book about Ruth.
Yeah, and I think another connection they had, and I guess nobody here is a pop psychiatrist, but I thought what was also interesting, what you mentioned, is Ruth's name that she had with her in the U.S. was not her born name. And though Admiral Rickover's last name was Rickover, Hyman was not his given name. It was Haim Gala Davida, I can't pronounce the middle name, born in Poland, and he was appointed to the Naval Academy from, I believe, it was a representative from Chicago that was also Jewish, right after World War II, which for those that study their American history, that the period between World War I and World War II was not the best time in the world to be Jewish, especially a Jewish immigrant from Poland. And that always in some ways set him apart, while at the same time he strived so much to be as institutional an American as you can. It's harder, I think, to be that than to go to one of the service academies. And when you absorb that early on, I think it informs a little bit of his toughness, but also his ability to rely on himself and not so much what most people would consider normal social networking institutions. Claude, you there?
Oh, sorry about that.
That's all right.
No, Rickover is the American success story. You're right to point out Poland. He recounts how he left Poland with his mother and his sister. His father was already in the United States. And there are Cossacks coming back from the war with Japan that are, you know, tapping on their cart as he's going over there. He talks about the poverty that his mother could only afford to buy 2 oranges a year for them, and only on a special occasion. And I think that stuck with him throughout, because, again, another aspect of Rickover that I was surprised about was his compassion, his deep compassion, especially for the poor. You see this on the streets of Shanghai, where he's telling Ruth, I saw this man, I'm pretty sure he was dying. I stayed with him as long as I could. I gave him some coins to be able to buy something for himself. And throughout his life, he's donating to a lot of charities, especially for children. And that's not something I think people would expect. But again, people are far more complex generally than just summing them up in a few words or a few sentences. I think the most powerful letters I came across that really made me stop to think. In 1982, he received a letter from a young kid from San Francisco, a 9-year-old. His first name was Hyman. He was Jewish. And he wrote, as many people from around the world wrote to Rickover, just fan mail. And again, try to imagine any flag officer in American history or today getting thousands of pieces of fan mail every year. And the 9-year-old says, my mom told me that your name is Hyman too, and that you build ships. And do you get angry when people make fun of your name? And here's about a page of this. Rickover didn't always respond to people, but in this way, he did this time. And he said, let me explain to you the how this name came about in our faith, even though Rickover would later admit he was atheist. He became Episcopalian for Ruth. And it's just this very compassionate letter, but then it hit me. I had seen so many letters written by Rickover that were signed H.G. Rickover. This was the only one I could find that was signed Hyman G. Rickover. And I think he was trying to connect with that young. I wish I could find that young man. I've actually tried to do a few searches to see, you know, what impact did that letter have on me, but I haven't been successful.
Yeah, I think his compassion comes through, but it also what comes through in his letters is once he seizes on a project, whatever it is, he pursues it with an amazing amount of diligence. And as you go along, you realize that this is why he's so intolerant of people who waste their talent. So talk about that a little bit.
He had high standards, but he sacrificed a lot of his life. By his own account, throughout his Navy career, he only averaged 4.5 days of vacation per year. I don't know how he operated on that way, but the fact is he's writing a lot of speeches about his thoughts on life. He wrote something like 200 speeches on various subjects, a lot of them on education, a lot on national security. But he really came to the basis that without having a vocation that you're truly passionate about, what effect are you going to have? How are you going to be able to work that at what you're doing, whatever it is? And he didn't distinguish between the nuclear physicist and the barber or whomever. He wanted people to get their jobs right because they understood that they had a mission. And I think what he sacrificed was a lot of time with people that he, you know, a lot of friendships. He had a few friends, obviously. But he got to know members of Congress very well, and he tended throughout his career to do something that admirals don't do today. In fact, I asked a retired four-star admiral about this. I said, hey, sir, I've got to ask you, did you and your wife ever go to, say, a play in D.C. with a senator and his wife? He said, are you kidding me? We could never do that. I said, okay, just want to make sure. But time and again, Rickover and his wives, first and second, are doing this, or they're going to the Speaker of the House's home, where the Speaker of the House is playing the piano for Rickover. Work was his life because he believed in the mission of the Navy and the United States and how he was committed to it. And I think he accepted those sacrifices as a result of what he wanted to do. And that's, I think, very understandable. And I think, quite frankly, if Rickover had retired on his own in November of 1980, at the height of his power, when the big Jimmy Carter was defeated, I think a lot of the negative notions about Rickover would have been mitigated. The reason I say that is, maybe we can talk about it another time. But I think, the antibiotics or whatever I'm taking. I lost my train of thought. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
That's the first time.
Yeah, we can reengage with the post 80 here in a bit.
I got it. Sorry about that. I think what pained him so much by being forcibly removed in late 81, early 82, is he had such passion. I don't think it was about power. This was his life's mission, and he had done it for so long, he didn't know what was next. That is my impression. Again, I'm not a psychologist. I'm a simple historian. But after reading everything I have about Rickover and by Rickover, that's my assessment. I could be wrong, and I hope historians will have a different perspective on that.
And I can imagine as a historian being able to access somebody who was passionately, and goodness knows he could outwork almost anybody for over half a century. I think that's also rather unique as opposed to somebody who just put 20 or 30 years in. And when you look at him, an incredibly intelligent person who got to where he was, not because of, like one of the people he mentions in one of his letters, because of the money his uncle had or anything like that, but of his own hard work. He went to the Naval Academy. I think it was 1946, he went to MIT to be one of the first people to learn about nuclear power. Yet he was not a credentialist. He did not wear his academic background or judge other people like that. And there was in one of his letters to, I believe it was Ruth, in 1930, this is something that I found, I wish more and more people thought like this. I'm going to do a little bit of an extended quote from Admiral Rickover here. Quote, I am becoming more tolerant of these men who have no book education. They are more likely to make decisions and can see matters clearly. I mean, intelligent men, of course. The thing that shocks me is all these officers who represent the younger generation already have closed minds. Aside from purely professional subjects, they are dead mentally. Certainly there is something woefully wrong with our system of education, which brings about a condition such as this, unquote. And you can see that a few times in his letters where he seems very frustrated by the people around him, like a lot of people like him, that don't share his enthusiasm for the broader requirements of the profession or that are willing to make the effort to think beyond the immediate. That part of his personality really comes out real early on as a junior officer.
Yeah, I agree. Throughout his career, he's making comments about the elites, and those could be the elites of the Navy. It could be the elites of corporations, of those who had extraordinary backgrounds and their family connections. He really was more of a humanities person when you think about it than a technologist. He wanted to understand, can these individuals think? And I want to say something else about, you know, the people around him. This is something else I started seeing. I started seeing the same names and actually the nicknames of his staff. He's joking around with the staff in a great way. There's some great memos in there that he's sending to them and to other people. And there's a continuity to it. There are people who are staying with him for 20, 30 years. All right, Rickover was a difficult individual, no question. But he also engendered loyalty from people. And I think that's the next step maybe that historians should take is, what was the difference between these populations? Why were some so incredibly loyal to him that they stayed around their entire careers working for the man? And I think they saw what he was doing. And at his heart, he was doing the right thing. And he took care of folks. I mean, there's one young lieutenant that he knows the lieutenant is moving out to the West Coast, I believe it was. And he said, hey, here's a few $1,000. Go buy yourself a house. Pay me back over the next 5 years. Okay, I want you and your wife to be okay, not have to worry about anything. And again, these are the things that people don't see. In fact, the first letter I came across that is in the files, it's the earliest letter, and I wish they went back to his Naval Academy days of 1918 to 1922. But he's at the U.S. Naval Hospital in Brooklyn, and he writes to Ruth, in the next room, a young officer is dying. His bride of 6 months has just arrived from California. I can see their brief period of happiness, now about to become nothing but a sad, sweet memory. How terrible it is. What bright hopes are being shattered. What poignant sorrow there is. And I think that's what initially drew me into this collection, is this was not an automaton. This was not a technologist. This is a man of passion. Perhaps he was able to hide it sometimes better than other times. I guess we all do that. But really very complex. And what I hope is that when people read this in its entirety, they'll understand that. And there's actually a reason why I didn't put the index in the book. There's something called the Washington Read, where people in Washington, D.C. will automatically go to the index of the book to see if they're in it or their boss is in it. And for this time, I figured, okay, it's going to be on Kindle, which I believe it's up now. It's available at Barnes & Noble and Amazon. People can search on Kindle. But I really, truly wanted people to see from beginning to end what this meant. And I think Eagle One hit on it, is you see this evolution of Rickover. Who was the man in the 70s and 80s? How did he get there? What was he thinking about? And you get a lot of answers by seeing the first couple of decades. You see somebody who is writing a memo to the Office of Legislative Affairs in, I think, 1950 or 51, and you can tell he's nervous writing this memo to OLA because he says, I don't know what to do. I was just contacted by a senator's office. What do I do? And I laughed out loud at one point, and Sam, who was working there at the time, heard me laugh as he did many times. And I said, that's extraordinary, because later on you start to see these letters where a congressman goes to Rickover because he can't get access to this. I think it was the House Appropriations chair. He says, yeah, the chair isn't seeing anybody, and I was told to come see you because you might be able to help. So Rickover calls the House Approach chair on his personal line and says, hey, can you see Congressman so-and-so? He said, yep, no problem, Rick. I'll take care of it. Boom. And it's that kind of evolution of how impactful he was. And again, we will not see his kind again for a couple of reasons. Number one, granted, NR nuclear reactors is, what, six? I think it's a six-year billet now. Forgive me, I'm not a nuke. I was a simple Intel dude. But Rickover had decades, and he established relationships directly with members of Congress and policymakers and presidents. At one point, he's having an event, and three former presidents show up. So I think what's important is I don't think we could have gotten the nuclear program up as quickly or as safely or with as much support from Congress if it hadn't been for Rickover. I know that's counter history, but it's tough to imagine something like that happening. What if Washington hadn't crossed the Delaware or something? What if it hadn't been Rickover? What if he, as a captain, in fact, Rickover says this, writes this at one point. I think it was in the 70s. He says, you know, all these, because he's talking about this memo that he gets from insiders. He said, you know, Rick, this is, just want to let you know, all the admirals met over in Monterey last week, and they said the biggest problem the Navy has isn't everything, it's Rickover. And he laughs, and he says, you know, what they don't realize is Bupers in D.C. All Bupers had to do in 1951 or 52 was assign me to Guam or some other place, and they never would have heard from me again. But instead, I had access, and he learned that access from the British. In fact, he develops very strong relationship with Lord Mountbatten. They have a correspondence going on for about 20 years. In fact, Mountbatten, I asked Eleanor about this when she was talking about one story, and I confirmed it in the papers, that Mountbatten had Eleanor and Rickover for dinner, and Rickover comes storming out of the salon or something to Eleanor, and she says, "What's wrong?" He goes, "He should know me better than that. He just offered me a knighthood in exchange for nuclear information or agreements." And he says, "I guess you're not going to be a lady now." She goes, "Oh, I'll always be a lady." So those relationships were very important to Rickover here and overseas and to the Navy.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact quote from the book, but the line, when he got the assignment to head to get into the nuclear business, the quote was something like, "Well, nobody likes him. He's an awful human being, but he'll get the job done." And I'm thinking, you know, that is the problem with, and I think he pointed out this is the problem, that the good old boy, you know, "I'll do enough to get things over. I'll keep this job for 3 years and move on." His view was completely opposite of that. And all he wanted to do was get the job done. And he was going to understand the job. He wanted to be in the job long enough to get a good grip on it. And he wanted his people to be on the job long enough to get a good grip with it. He really was lambasting the Navy system of putting some ridiculous line officer like me in charge of a bunch of technical people and leaving them there for a year and a half or 2 years and then moving on to some other position. I mean, he was quite adamant about knowing your job and knowing your people and knowing what they're up to.
Yeah, and that was part of his interviews. Now, I should say in the around 63 or 64, there was a letter from the CNO that said, "Hey, Rick, I'm going to be, you know, retiring here in a few weeks and, you know, loved working with you all this time. And by the way, this interview thing, would you kind of ease up on the kids, please, just for me, please do this." And of course the interviews went on for a while, but one of the, certainly probably the most famous person to come out of those interviews was Jimmy Carter, who we established a relationship, especially in the 1970s, because when he interviewed Carter, he said, "Did you do your best?" And Carter said, "Well, not always." He says, "Why not the best?" And so Carter took that on as his campaign slogan, "Why not the best?" And early on, I think Carter was still a governor at the time. This is, 72 or 73. It was really early. And Carter wrote to him and said, "Admiral, I just want to let you know I plan on running for president in 76. I would like your support. I'd like to ask you about national security issues." And so begins a correspondence between the two, to the point where Rickover could call the White House and say, could I talk to the president? Could I go see the president? I'm sure to the consternation of every Navy officer at that point. But at one point, Rickover is in his condo, and there's a knock on the door, and Eleanor had put out, five plates. He says, "Well, who's coming over tonight?" And she says, "Oh, I just invited a couple of people." And there's a knock on the door. He opens it up, and it's President Carter and his wife and Amy and a couple Secret Service agents. And he looks over at Eleanor. I said, I wasn't expecting this. Well, the nice thing about this collection is we know everything that was discussed at that dinner, because Rickover wrote a memorandum for the record that was about, I think, 8 pages long. And all I could think of was this, that apparently Eleanor and Mrs. Carter had been on a trip, and Eleanor had said, why don't you come over for dinner sometime? So the two of them concocted this. And I thought the intent, I assume the intent was, let's just have a nice evening relaxing. Well, when you start to see this memorandum for the record and all the topics they're covering that are really being covered by Rickover talking, I can't imagine what that dinner must have been like. But it's just one of those stories where he has this incredible relationship with people.
And I think that's, you know, one of the lessons that you know, hopefully younger people of an interest will get out of this. And, you know, it's one thing that I think I've mentioned on the show before, that I never cracked the code about, I wish I had, until I was like a mid-grade 04, is the importance of networks, not glad-handing, you know, kiss up, push down, but just as you go through your professional career, maintaining a connection of acquaintances and friends and nurturing that and maintain that. Because not only does it make for a more enjoyable, richer life, but there can be points down the road where you can tap into that network. And when you mentioned the Carter story, I was like, he was right after World War II. Exactly. Carter graduated from the Naval Academy in 1946. And then he went into, you know, did his naval. So sometime in the early 1950s was when he had his initial interaction with Rickover. And then lo and behold, a couple decades later, that connection gets reached back, and it goes on for another decade and a half. I thought there was a really sweet note towards the end in the mid-80s that President Carter sent to Rickover after he had gone through all his travails. And you can, I think a lot of that comes from the fact, and I want to, because it's, we had the full hour, I could do extended quotes from the book here. I wanted to tie together a few things, so correct me if I'm scrolling as I scroll through here, that goes back to 1929. Now, 1929, Rickover is only 30 years old. He's kind of an old soul early. And in this letter to Ruth in September of 1929, as a 30-year-old, beginning the quote, I met an interesting officer at the country club near Westinghouse, Captain McAtee. We talked for quite a while about world affairs. He recommended that I read Das Kapital. One statement he made was surprising, that a man on the New York Times staff who writes the naval editorials is a retired British naval officer. If you could verify this, that would be a fine point to make in one of your seminars. I'll break from the quote. Again, that talks about how they communicated about their mutual professional activities. Anyway, returning to the quote. I find that I am always very much at ease in conversing with older officers because they generally talk about international affairs and cultural subjects. The younger ones are not that way. They talk more petty matters and various technical details. Captain McAtee quoted Eddington, the physicist, as saying that a man has to mind but half open who believes only those things that are true which he can actually see and hear, that there is a great deal more that must be accepted on faith. And then a little later on, if I shift over here a few pages, if I can do this confidently, he also talks about tolerance, going back to that level of tolerance. And this is in late 29, so he's still a 30-year-old officer here. My own experience has taught me that if I had been judged according to the strict interpretation of the law or naval regulations, that I would have been court-martialed more times than I can count. Therefore, I have learned to be tolerant of transgressions of those about me and treat my subordinates as leniently and decently as I myself have been treated. And then we go all the way over to, I think that's page 86. Again, be tolerant of me as I scroll around my Kindle here. Here we go. This is in 35-year-old man. Quote, by the way, we have last learned why we are... This is the cynical part of it, which is great. Go back to the quote. Quote, by the way, we have learned that we are here to celebrate. It is the 150th anniversary of Commodore Perry's retirement from the Navy. Now, Isn't that a wonderful excuse for dragging a number of warships all the way to San Francisco? For I understand he was about to be court-martialed, so he conveniently retired. And you have this, later on, he wasn't a very good culture critic. Before they made the movie, he got the book Gone with the Wind that he recommended, and then said, I don't think this book will last very long. He wasn't too impressed with it. And then he quotes another book that I don't recall about Reconstruction, but now I want to read it. So he also, in I believe 1936, he recommended, I believe I have this right, he had just finished Mein Kampf and was sending Mein Kampf to Ruth to read. And they talked a lot about German, and they communicated in German on a regular basis. So this is not the hyper-technical, grumpy engineer who was just focused on things nuclear and making sure that everything was gone by a checklist. This was a learned man who understood a whole variety of subjects that he cared about deeply, though he did really have what we nowadays call a STEM bias in how he viewed the proper education of a naval officer.
Yeah, and I think you see that reflected in his – sorry about that, that's my dog. I think you see that reflected in the topics of his speeches on, say, competency-based education or humanity and technology. But even the 200-plus hearings at which he testified between 1950 and 1982, which I think is a record that will stand for any American – I don't know if anybody who's done that much, but when you look at the variety of committees, yeah, there's the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, Armed Services, but then Committee on Labor, Committee on Banking, Committee on Labor and Public Welfare, et cetera, Select Committee on Small Business. Rickover is everywhere, and certainly some of the admirals were saying, you know, he's in our lane, get him out of our lane, because he doesn't know our lane. I would argue that he probably, because of the amount that he read and absorbed and he thought about, because his books that we got, that we sent over to the library, are all marked up. The articles that he read are all marked up. He's thinking about this and commenting it to himself so he could understand these issues in a way. That's why he could call these people like Milton Friedman and have a conversation about, economics. He could talk to the Chief Justice at a party about a certain case that had just come up, because he delved into it in a way nobody else did. And I'm sounding hagiographic. I don't mean to sound that way, but I think again what I said at the beginning is Rickover is far more complex than the two or three bullets we normally hear about him. And even when Francis Duncan is writing his biography, he did two books. When he's writing his biography, he's interviewing people, and he collects about three pages, and he just goes to them and says, what's the first word that comes to your mind when you think of Rickover? And there's a lot of negative things in there, but you know what? There's a lot of positive things in there too. So I think it's very dependent, and I think that's why you need to understand the whole individual and his whole career rather than just his being acerbic with reporters or the people that he interviewed.
Yeah, I was talking with my wife on the way down to Virginia Beach from where we were, and I was talking about one of the things, the advantages, if you want to call it that Rickover had, is that he had fewer distractions to deal with than we do today. There was no television. Radio was kind of in its infancy. So he, you know, what do smart people do when you don't have radio or television and are interested in the world? You know, in those days you read. And I think that really set the pattern for his life. He would get into a subject. If he wanted to study about economics, he would, you know, get into economics. He didn't mess around with distractions. In fact, he was very critical of the Naval Academy's efforts at athletic supremacy. He didn't think that should even be a part of the Academy program, although he was in favor, I guess, of intramural athletics. But it's just interesting to me that, you know, the focus he had and how he kept pursuing this stuff. And you know, you keep wondering about the number of efforts to get him fired made by Defs and Secretary of the Navy, and only have the people who knew him, a lot of these congressmen and others, and respected him, save him and promote him. And I'm sure that just didn't endear him to every CNO and Secretary of the Navy that came along. Talk a little bit about how his charmed life, if you will, was. I mean, we already talked about it. He laid a foundation for his charmed life. He worked hard to get there. But talk a little bit about the people who really disliked him and how much of that was based on the power that he actually was able to maybe unintentionally, but that he didn't really seek power, but that he had a lot of power.
He did. I think the key one is that Monterey meeting of the flag officers that said, yeah, he's the biggest problem we have in the Navy, but he's got Congress on his side, so we just have to deal with him. But to get back to your point about athletics, yeah, he actually makes a lot of comments about that. He's one of the comments he makes to his official biographer is, his biographer's saying, what contributed most to your success? He says, well, while I was studying, the other officers were off playing golf, and that's the difference. He certainly didn't have love for, some of the athletic programs because it took away from the mission of what the Navy was supposed to do. So, yeah, he didn't endear himself with some people. And that goes to organizations as well. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I think that he wasn't a rah-rah Naval Academy graduate where he couldn't do no wrong. I think he was as critical and blunt and upfront with the expectations he had of the institutions that he deemed were important or should be important as he was with himself. So I guess it's fair in the reading that he expected no more of other people he didn't expect of himself. And you see that arc too in something that every naval person is familiar with in the U.S. and especially those who spend way too much time in D.C. Bump into all the time. And that's the U.S. Naval Institute and Proceedings. And the first time that we see it mentioned in the letters is, again, a letter in Ruth in 1935 where Proceedings was still paying authors. And let's see, I did write that in my notes here. I think it was an article, quote, on international law in the submarine in 1935. It must have been after he got through reading his German, where he was happy that he got money in the mail because they didn't pay naval officers all that much during the height of the Depression. But then, again, the wealth of information we have a half a century, 50 years later, by the time we reach the mid-80s, he has gone through a complete arc of his feelings towards and his expectations of the Naval Institute and Proceedings. It's a really interesting arc about not only the person, but the institution as well.
Yeah, what I thought was interesting, and of course, the Institute is always touting that Rick Over wrote for them as a junior officer. However, when you're reading these letters, and he's writing to and from Ruth again, he really, keep in mind that this article was probably either co-written or certainly highly influenced by Ruth, because they started writing about this topic about 5 years before the article was published. So this is a long-term thing. And she had more expertise in international relations, obviously. But the only thing he really mentions when it's published is, oh, I got my check from the Institute. And that's it. It's not like, hey, I was published by the Naval Institute. That didn't matter to him. And then Ruth makes a comment, well, I read the article that won the general essay, and it seems like there are just like three things you have to do: talk in some keywords and talk about a big Navy and something else, and then they dismiss it. And then in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s, you start to see more of his letters to and from the Naval Institute. And at one point, he resigns, then joins up again. He is displeased with the content that's being provided. He's pretty harsh. In fact, he writes to one of the CNOs, like, why is the Naval Institute publishing leadership articles by people who are lieutenant JGs and lieutenants? What do they know? Shouldn't we have business leaders or admirals writing about this? So he's pretty critical. And in fact, maybe it was the vice chief. It was the vice chief at that point. Said, you know what? You're right. They shouldn't be doing that. But of course, it continued. So yeah, there's a lengthier history with the Naval Institute and Rickover But again, it hasn't, some of the stuff hasn't come out. You know, it's the same when they talk about how Preble Hall, the Naval Academy Museum, was built by Naval Institute, and it's far more complex, and it's a story for another day, but it's really not true. They provided a portion, but there's a reason they provided that, because anyway, I'll leave it at that. So yeah, but it's just one organization, and yeah, you could be critical of a lot of organizations because he expected better of everybody, including himself. He did not expect anything of anybody, whether it was working harder, learning more, and going back to your comment, Eagle One, you know, certainly there was TV in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, but I didn't see much indication that Rickover watched television much until he was really retired around 82, 83. Before that, it's all books. He's absorbing information at an incredible rate. I don't think I've ever seen evidence of a flag officer or any other officer as prolific in their reading as Rickover.
Yeah, I think he was. He was so, you know, one of the interviews in the book is the one where he's talking to a young midshipman, I guess, who majored in English literature, and he asked this young man, you know, who are your favorite poets, and you know, he lists a number of names, and then he starts asking questions about those poets, and this kid knows nothing. You know, I mean, he couldn't remember the dates. He didn't know what, you know, who wrote Ode on a Grecian Urn. What education did this kid have, and how would he apply himself if he didn't know somebody? And Rickover was not looking for people to memorize stuff, but he did think that if you studied English literature, you ought to know something about English literature. And I thought that was just perfect. That was one of those great questions and interviews. So it was a good point.
He also
hated administrators. I mean, just the concept of people being in charge of people who administrated, I guess. I mean, he was really going off on this in one of his speeches. And I you know, that there's a whole unnecessary layer of bodies and the way of getting things done. Can you kind of talk about that a little bit?
Sorry, Eagle One, you broke off. The bodies?
Yeah, the bodies of administrators who got in the way of actually accomplishing anything.
I know we don't have a lot of time left, but I will say this. Regarding all the administrators, there was the Night of the Long Knives. And Rickover lost his power in 81, 82. And this was told to me, actually, by a vice admiral who was one of his contemporaries. He's still alive, class of 1950. And he was a vice admiral during Carter's administration. And he said, you know, Claude, I think his biggest problem was once the members of Congress and senators who started either losing their elections or dying because they were older by then, he didn't have as much power on Capitol Hill. And with that, I'll use your term, the administrators could move in for the kill. And that's what I think. People have long memories, and they seize that opportunity.
Yeah, power can be ethereal when you lose your access to people and influence. Those that are still around that don't wish you well, they can always be very careful around long-dwell bureaucrats is a good rule to use. As we're getting near the top of the hour, Claude, I wanted to pull out one part from towards the end of the collection. This is from 1983, and ironically, it takes place right after what we were talking about a few minutes ago about the Lieutenant J.G. telling everybody how to be a great leader. It was a conversation with Admiral Watkins. This is a phone conversation, the transcript of it that was put in later. And right after saying how ludicrous what that was, Admiral Watkins asked him, quote, how was your trip to China? And Rickover responded, and this is 1983. And I'll just break in here. You know, there's been a lot of people in the last 5-10 years that are all of a sudden sobered up about the People's Republic of China and their Navy And a lot of us, a lot of the people who are 1, 2, 3-star admirals right now, senior captains, we all grew up hearing about how primitive it was. And, oh, all these people are surprised. They should not have been surprised because it was well known. And Rickover is one of those people that tried to warn people. And, again, this is January of 1983. Rickover responding to Watkin about his recent trip to the People's Republic of China. Rickover, I was well received there. Don't kid yourself about their Navy. They are first rate, and anyone who thinks otherwise should be aware. Their ships are among the cleanest I've ever seen, Watkins surprised. Watkins replied, quote, absolutely. Although their ships are predominantly old, their sailors are superb. They are outstanding seafarers, and I agree that anyone who puts their Navy down does not know the facts, end quote. And I think that that was just a great eye-opener to people who, when they read that, they should back up and go, okay, if two of the most powerful and influential people in the Navy knew this about the People's Republic of China, and if you track their economic growth from 83 to now, you can have a rough corollary to the military. Why did that not sink in earlier? And there's people who I'm sure can get their PhDs on that as well. I thought that was a neat Easter egg to see. And this is Rickover, somebody who at that point had 45 years to look at China, because as a CO of a small ship in the late 1930s, he was right there in the heart of the growing conflict between China and Japan in, I think, 36 through 38.
Yeah, he was definitely, he was there mostly in 37 and I think part of 38 as he's watching this. And then he treks across part of Asia to ostensibly meet up with Ruth. He wasn't able to meet up with her, I think in India it was. But he writes a very lengthy assessment about his route and sends it to the Office of Naval Intelligence, and a copy is in this. He'd made a great intelligence officer. I mean, he was in Israel and Egypt in the 70s and early 80s. So he's being given the red carpet treatment to everybody. At one point, he's over in the Soviet Union with Vice President Nixon. That's how they established their relationship during the Eisenhower administration. And they're talking back and forth, hey, remember when we were on this ship and you asked this question?
Well, we've eaten up the hour. This book, I think many people will be surprised by, as you said, the human side of Rickover, because most people, including my generation of naval officers, knew only the cantankerous reputation, and if you ever were in Mare Island Naval Shipyard when he was going to make an appearance, the Rickover is coming, Rickover is coming, you know, like some fearsome giant. And he is a fearsome giant in a lot of ways, because he led this country into the leading position of the enterprise that he was in charge of. And you can't say more than that for a man who worked as hard as he did. It was a great job. Anyway, I think this book is a brilliant addition to the Rickover story, and I hope it does very well. Thanks for being with us today, Claude.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
And again, thanks, Claude, for coming on and joining us. And I think you're exactly right. There are five or six books that are in this collection for future people to be able to grab hold of and run with. And the resources and the work that the archivist and the library has done that you mentioned at the start of the show, I think is going to pay dividends for a long time. And personally, I would love to see, they did a young Indiana Jones. How about a young Hyman and Ruth from his time when he turned over command in 37 in China to the world before the war? I'd watch that movie. But I wish you the best of the holiday season, Claude, and we look forward to having you on again sooner more than later.
Thanks.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Mid-Rats. And until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy day. Cheers.
Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame for love of Shirley. Piccadilly.